Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was back in 1730 that Japan would officially authorized the Dojima Rice Exchange in Osaka. This would be widely regarded as the world's first organized futures exchange, long before we saw futures exchanges emerging in markets like the United States. Traders were able to buy and sell contracts on rice almost a century before what we would know today as the futures market. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the interim results of the Standard Bank Group. We speak to the Group Chief Executive Officer, Sim Tshabalala, about the performance of that business. Strong headline earnings starting off the first half of the year and strong momentum going into the second half of the year. We get his thoughts on what is driving that business from a growth perspective and what might have that business worried from a macro perspective. We have a conversation as well with the Minister of Tourism, Minister Patricia de Lille, around that electronic immigration system that was launched yesterday by the president. We're going to take a look at that and see what we can make of those developments. Then we have a conversation with the Department of Small Business Development. We speak to the Deputy Director General for Enterprise Development in that department around their presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Small Business Development yesterday. The Spaza Shop Fund, the 500 million rand fund that we had been told is going to be aimed at supporting spaza shops in South Africa. We're going to get a sense of how that deployment has been going and how that rollout has been going. We also have a conversation with independent defense analyst Kobus Mare to get his thoughts on Arms Corps' decision to review their intellectual property portfolio and see what we make of the size of that portfolio. And because it's Thursday, as always, on a Thursday, we've got a small business conversation to be had. We speak to the founder and CEO of Neo Heights Aviation Group, get a sense of how that business was built.
The day's markets, clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements that have been happening or taking place throughout the day. We try and make sense of those movements. I'm joined on the line by Head of Investment Research and Content at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at market movements and see what to make of them. Chantal, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Oil price, rather volatile today. We've just come off $85 a barrel at the moment, already back at $87 a barrel. Markets kind of trying to make heads or tails of what's happening there. Let's perhaps start the conversation there. What do you make of the volatility in the oil price today?
Well, I think it's a function of us not really knowing what is happening on the supply side and also not sure what's happening on the demand side. So that makes for a very volatile situation. And I think the supply side really is the biggest issue here. We do have a Strait of Hormuz that is not operating as it should be. You have conflicting reports about how close we are to kind of a full-scale a ceasefire. And as long as that happens, you are going to have issues around whether or not oil is moving in the places that it's supposed to be moving. And then you have the demand picture as well. Lots of uncertainty in terms of the global growth outlook. We do have things going quite well in the US, but you have a Chinese economy that still seems to be struggling, and we are not sure where it's heading near term.
Chantal, that oil price and the uncertainty around it, is this perhaps markets punishing the US for crying wolf too many times around the ceasefire? We've had so many conversations back and forth around whether we're in a ceasefire, whether we're not, whether it holds or it doesn't, who controls the strait, and markets at some point surely are only assessing what's is relevant to them. And if you're looking at tracking maps of the ships that are going through the strait, that could be a very different picture from what is being reported on in the official reports.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the boy that cried wolf. In this case, the Trump that cried wolf. But in the opposite direction, right? And I think that that's where the issue is right now. So I don't think that you are going to see this volatility subside until there's pen to paper, until we actually start seeing movement through the strait, or alternative means of moving oil around is established. And that could take a really long time. This will have an impact from a market's perspective, but thankfully, we do have some counteractive themes or counteracting themes that are really helping us to navigate these markets at the moment, and overall seeing still rising markets despite all of this chaos. And the biggest of them all is still that AI thematic.
Chantal, those rising markets, let's take a look at perhaps where we're seeing some of that strength come through. The Nikkei in Tokyo still potentially paying a bit of catch up given that Japan was closed early in the week for that Mountain Day holiday. But markets by and large, kind of a bit of a mixed bunch there. FTSE in London down about 0.5%, the Nasdaq up about 0.8%. Locally, resource stocks absolutely taking a hiding, whilst financial stocks trying to keep the local markets afloat. It doesn't seem as though the volatility is largely being driven by the earnings numbers and that, because we've gone through those earnings reports, and a lot of those reports were positive towards that AI thematic that you allude to. What risks still sit there, not perhaps from a market perspective, but even from your perspective when you're looking at the markets, what do you see as potential risks here?
Yeah, I think in the local context, really the growth outlook is the biggest risk, particularly if you look outside that volatile resources sector. Because the resources sector is going to do what it does. When oil goes up, it seems at this point in time, gold and PGMs come under pressure, and that is why you see this massive drag on our index. But a healthy market isn't only a function of one specific index or sector. It really needs broad-based strength. And when you have very cyclical industries like that, most of that broad-based strength should be coming from your industrial and your financial counters. Thankfully, today we actually had a bit of that counterbalance because Truworths released better than expected numbers and a better than expected, well, it was still pretty poor, but a better than expected trading statement. So that kind of lifted the industrial space, and the financial sector has really held up well. But ultimately, from a South African perspective, we will require growth, and any further disappointments in growth will be bad for markets more broadly speaking. And then when we look at the US, I think the AI story is going to remain front and center. And that's where we have seen most of the gains coming through. And it now becomes a question of, are we still buying these companies and holding these companies at reasonable valuations? Are we still very confident that the CapEx spending that is going through is going to materialize into reasonable returns? At this point in time, I must say I'm becoming a little bit more of a believer that we are still at the start of this kind of AI bubble inflating, because valuations don't look too bad and those earnings numbers are absolutely fantastic. So those are, I think, the main risks. And then obviously in the broader context, the same as we being very concerned about South African growth, the global growth story, perhaps as a function of the chaos in the Middle East, also remains a point of tension.
Chantal, I can't let you go without looking at those TFG numbers in a bit more detail. The TFG Group has, over the last period of time, I want to say September of 2025 to kind of now-ish, bought back about R1 billion worth of shares, and it's only 3% of the shares at an average price of around R105 a share. Today, that share price, 10 months later, is just below 50, or just above R50 a share. Basically, they bought back R1 billion worth of shares that are worth half that price almost. What do you make of that, and perhaps where companies might be finding themselves if we have to learn from these share buybacks and the timings of these share buybacks?
Look, it's very difficult for company management teams and for anyone really to predict sentiment. And once sentiment is negative, then you will get pressure on your share price. And sometimes that persists for quite some time. And sometimes it's not the company specifically, but it could be market conditions or sector-wide conditions more generally. When companies decide to buy back the shares, they decide it based on the fact that they think their share price is undervalued, firstly, and secondly, they think that that investment in their own shares is going to give them their shareholders a better return than what would have happened if they had invested that money in the business. So when you're in a low growth environment and you're struggling to find ideas in terms of how to invest excess cash, buying back shares when your share price is cheap makes sense. There's no way for them to predict how long that sentiment or that soft environment will persist. So you can't really penalize management for it. Ultimately, you should get an earnings per share uplift when they buy back shares, hopefully at lo as low at prices as low as possible. But you will get that per share uplift in earnings, and ultimately it will benefit the shareholder. Unfortunately, the timing isn't always perfect.
If we had perfect timing, then the markets wouldn't be as interesting as they are. That's the reason why markets keep us on our toes and keep us interested, because we don't know what's going to happen next. We're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. Head of Investment Research and Content at FNB Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, joining us to share her thoughts on markets, some of the movements that have been unfolding there.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? Recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity. Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system is kinda dear macar. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The Standard Bank Group reported their interim results for the 6 months ended 30 June 2026. Headline earnings for that business growing double digits, return on equity well within the target range for their 2028 targets. The business showing strength across all metrics locally and on the African continent. We're going to be taking a look at the results in a bit more detail with the Group Chief Executive Officer, Sim Shabalala. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Malume Sim, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The group just can't stop winning.
Yes. 52,000 people making 10 decisions every day is a huge, huge momentum that gets built, resulting in that 26 billion rand, up 10% and ROE of 19.8%. So it's the outcome of thousands of people doing good work every day.
Malume Sim, let's take a look at the operational performance of the business, especially on the African continent. Globally, we find ourselves in a very precarious position with all of the geopolitical events that are unfolding and that have been unfolding for the majority of this year. Despite this, the group still able to have 40% of its earnings coming from the rest of Africa, currently in almost 50% of the African countries. The Standard Bank Group has a presence in 21 out of the 54 countries on the continent. The business not particularly fazed by some of the macro factors that are out of your control, carrying on almost as though these factors will find you along the way. What's the secret for the business here?
To me, it's portfolio theory. Portfolio theory. When parts of the business are doing well, in this year, CIB, others will struggle, BCB, PPB. But when the cycle turns, it'll be the retail bank doing better than the wholesale bank. And that's been the case over the last 30 years, for as long as I've been in banking. So we've got a great portfolio, 21 countries. Those countries that you refer to make up 80% of African GDP, which is large. And they made, like you correctly point out, 10.4 billion rand. That is 7% up. The really interesting thing, Jimmy, was that to make your macro point, interest rates declined throughout the continent, well, in many countries on the continent, in addition to which the currencies in a number of countries weakened versus the South African rand. So that 10.4 growth was actually 11%. That growth on 10.4 is 11% in constant currency, in other words, in local currency. But when you convert it to the rand, it was 7%. So yes, a portfolio, East Africa, flat, South and Central, up 6%. And the hero in that set of businesses is West Africa. They were up 13%.
Well, Lomasim, can we take a look at the investment from the business's perspective? Increasing or adding another $80 million into expanding Tanzanian operations, just recently announced there, of course. We're looking at this set of numbers. We're looking at the growth from a revenue perspective. And it's important to contextualize this. We're only halfway through the year.
Yes, so we are making investments, and those investments are actually meant to do exactly what you referred to, add to our top line, to our revenues. So we've made an investment that the CFO spoke about this morning into our business in Tanzania, and we're about to do the same, actually increase our shareholding in our Angolan bank to 75%. It's going to happen by way of IPO. How much we'll be pumping in will be dependent on the pricing of that IPO. We continue, as we said in the presentation, to support our clients as they make investments, as they put in place their trading activities, whether they're importers or exporters. And we're doing that throughout the continent, and therefore growing organically and taking advantage then of these secular trends on the continent, infrastructure, demographics, growing trade with other trading blocks, but also trade on the African continent. And the group is well positioned to take advantage of all of that.
Speaking of taking advantage of those relationships and those trade routes that are opening up, I want to get your thoughts, Malumisim, around how it is that the bank then approaches the remainder of the year and perhaps subsequent years. We are well on course to hitting the 28 targets of return on equity of between 18 and 22%. We're almost at the 20% mark, and I suspect by the end of the year, we could very well have breached that level. We know that 2028 is still a couple of years away, but at the rate at which the bank is moving, this target could be reached sooner rather than later. How then does the bank start to think about growth differently on the African continent with a presence that, as we said earlier, is already almost at 50% of the continent? And that's not where the bank is limited to. There's operations in London, there's operations in Hong Kong. How does the business then start to execute the remainder of the strategy between now and 2028?
Jimmy, the rugby enthusiasts amongst your listeners will say that the Currie Cup was not won in June. So we only really in August right now, and we've committed to the investment community that on banking revenues, our guidance is will be in mid to high single digits. We've said cost income ratio below 50%. And then we've set a group ROE that will be higher than 2025. And we think we will get there. We've also said, and as you correctly analyze, that we are going to get our headline earnings per share to between 8 and 12% CAGR during that period to 2028. And we're going to get our ROE between the target of range of 18 to 22%. Every action that we take is calculated to get us there. And in fact, having said that to you, you are familiar with a Gordon growth model where you need to grow your return on equity, but also you need to grow your revenues and your earnings. And we laser focused on all the levers necessary to do that. Those levers include growing our lending book, making sure that it's appropriately managed from a risk perspective. So allocate the capital, but make sure that the risk is tight. Holding our costs tightly. So we've had 10 consecutive reporting periods of positive jaws. That's some kind of a record, Jimmy. There are many things we cannot control, like the macros and interest rates, but we can control who gets hired, at what cost, how productive are they, and so forth. So we're heavily, heavily focused on those. On the continent, we think the entire continent is attractive, actually. We think that as it gets increasingly integrated, it becomes more and more attractive to people that are looking for either the resources that the continent produces, or to invest in the infrastructure that the continent will be building, or to invest in the human capital that is on the continent. And so all of those factors will generate higher revenues. We will manage the costs as best as we can. We'll be judicious in allocating our capital. That'll produce headline earnings, as well as the return on equity we're referring to.
Well, listen, before I let you go, what has you and the management team concerned, if anything? It doesn't seem at face value that there's a lot that can concern the group, given the current momentum track that you're on. But I can imagine with external factors, such as those we alluded to earlier, there must be something that keeps you wanting to stay laser focused on your objectives. What are those concerns for you and the group?
We're paranoid about competition. The competition in South Africa and on the continent is ferocious. And so we obsess about what our competitors are doing. You know, is APSA's home loans business getting better than ours? Why is it getting better than ours? Where can we learn from what they're doing? What's First Rand doing? What can we learn? What's StanChart doing? So being focused on competition. What are the fintechs doing that we're not doing? So being focused on competition. Secondly, crime generally, but cybercrime in particular. The sophistication of the crime out there is astonishing. And then thirdly, the war in the Middle East, as well as in the Ukraine, and also the various wars on the African continent are a deep source of concern.
A laser focus on continuing momentum and not being detracted by external factors that the business has no control over. The Standard Bank Group reporting strong headline earnings for the first 6 months of their new financial year. Return on equity growing in line with their expectations, and the business continuing to focus on how it is that they keep those metrics on the up. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Group Chief Executive Officer Sim Tshabalala joining us to reflect on the first 6 months of their financial year and what the next 6 months could hold.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The electronic travel authorization system was officially launched at OR Tambo International Airport yesterday by President Cyril Ramaphosa. This is set to digitize South Africa's border management systems and ensure that we're able to achieve more efficiency or more efficient control over biometrics, facial recognition, and all manner of things that affect our borders. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Minister of Tourism, Minister Patricia de Lille. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this announcement. Auntie Pat, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly a significant milestone for South Africa's border management conversations, but also broadly for our efforts to digitize our systems in the country.
Yes, indeed, it's a big enabler and a game changer for tourism, of course. And I want to commend the Department of Home Affairs and SARS for designing a system that keeps the balance between, security and making sure that we have ease of travel for our visitors. So now that we've gone digital with the system, it's now just one application, one answer within a matter of 24 hours. So there's no longer, a need to go and stand in a queue or at Home Affairs or to go to an embassy or a mission of South Africa abroad. And people also have now the option of renewing their visa, if you're 90 days at a time. On their phones or on their laptops. So the ease that for traveling now is much better. And we are targeting the five big source markets India, China, Mexico and Indonesia. That's where the Home Affairs have tested the system since the G20. And we are in the process of rolling out a digital marketing campaign to inform India, China, Mexico, Indonesia, that one of the stumbling blocks of coming to us as a long-haul distance, I mean, destination has now been removed. So we're very, very excited about this.
Auntie Pat, while we're looking at the importance of this from a tourism perspective, I wanted to get your thoughts around the approval from Cabinet of the new SA Tourism Board. Obviously, that has been something you and I have spoken about in the past and the importance of having that board in place. The timing of that coming very, very nicely in with this as well. If we're aiming to open up South Africa to the world, to Africa, having that tourism board approved, having this electronic travel system in place, this is coming at a very good time.
Yes, definitely. The board that served in the interim, they've been able to stabilize the organization. You know, as government, we invest at least 1.2 billion rand a year to market South Africa as a destination of choice. And with the new board coming on soon, now that it has been gazetted, I'm sure that they will continue to drive that agenda of growth, economic growth. The value of the contribution of tourism to our GDP and economic growth is undervalued and understated. And for every 13 arrivals that we see in our country, it creates at least one job and two direct and then two indirect jobs. So tourism plays a massive role in economic growth. We contribute at least 5% to the GDP. And with the ETA now and a further strategy that we have also embarked on, a plan that was approved by Cabinet, which is the Tourism Route Development Marketing Strategy, to bring more direct flights to our country. I think with those two alone, the new board will be able to help us to even grow tourism further. We had a record year last year when we received 10.5 million visitors to our country. And but we can't rest on our laurels because the competition, you know, with Thailand, Australia and other countries, we have to be on our toes all the time.
And part of being on our toes is ensuring that we have the adequate systems in place to be able to welcome those individuals into our country. Auntie Pat, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around how it is that we move forward from here, or rather we continue to leverage off of this momentum. As you mentioned, we don't have time to rest on those laurels. If we are to address the unemployment crisis that we have, we know the president yesterday spoke as well about the fact that this new system would create more jobs in the country. You mentioned, of course, that tourism is a big catalyst towards job creation. How do we now start to look at perhaps other areas that we can improve on to strengthen this initiative that we've clearly been able to get over the line?
Yes, of course. You know, I think this is a clear illustration of government departments working together. You know, Home Affairs, Department of Tourism, State Security, and the Department of Transport. And, you know, if we can continue to collaborate, you know, more closely as government departments, and tourism has been selected as one of the four sectors within our economy that can help us to grow the economy, to get us out of the stagnant 1% growth. So really, I think that, you know, we can learn a lot from other countries. And, of course, we have to do a lot more. I launched a tourism month today in Durban. And again, you know, we send out a very strong message to say to our African brothers and sisters in the SADC region, you know, that they are welcome to visit our country.
South Africa is welcome to receiving visitors and welcome to having those visitors come in and explore our country, of course, doing so via the correct channels. And those channels are through or being enhanced through mechanisms such as the electronic travel authorization that's been recently approved. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Minister in the Department of Tourism, Minister Patricia de Lille, joining us to take a look at that travel authorization system and how it is that it can benefit South Africa.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The Department of Small Business Development recently presented to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Small Business Development the progress of the Spaza Shop Fund that was announced a little while ago, a 500 million rand fund aimed at supporting Spaza Shop owners in various respects. We're going to take a look at these recent presentations in a bit more detail with the Deputy Director General of Enterprise Development at the Department of Small Business Development, Tlinisile Delwa. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Medelwa, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Can we perhaps start with update on where it is that we stand with regards to the disbursement of the fund, the 500 million rand fund that was announced? We know that from what we can see and what's been publicly available, less than 100 million rand has been dispersed across all of the applications that have come through. Can you just give us an overview of where we stand in terms of disbursements?
Thank you so much, Jimmy. Good afternoon to you and good afternoon to the listeners. Jimmy, I think one needs to just first remind the listeners on how the fund is structured. We have 500 million, which is a fund between the Department of Small Business Development and the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. 350 million is from DTIC through the NEF, and then 150 million is from the Department of Small Business Development through the SIDFA, which is the agency. The 150 million that we were reporting on to our portfolio committee and as the Department of Small Business Development is limited to stock, which is a grant element of the fund. However, the NEF does have the 350, which they are disbursing as well. It's a grant as well as a loan, and it involves upgrading of building infrastructure, systems, shelving, and refrigeration. So I really want for the listeners to distinguish between the two, because the NEF has disbursed also on their side, and I don't have their latest figures, but I'm really going to be speaking strictly to the 150 million that DSBD is contributing to the fund.
Medelwa, can we take a look at the intended beneficiaries of these funds? The Spaza Shop owners, we know that the Department of Small Business Development has also been on a registration drive to ensure that we correctly register these Spaza Shops in the country. We correctly record the ownership structures of that. Where do we stand on that, and how is that perhaps influencing how it is that disbursements are taking place on the fund side?
Okay, the registration of Spaza Shops is a project that was given to the Department of Small Business since 2024 after the incident of foodborne illnesses, if you recall. And that project has been ongoing since that time. And we are working with municipalities who then give us the data of those Spaza Shop owners who have approached them to apply for a business license or a permit because they already have Spaza Shops or they intend to open Spaza Shops. That process has progressed, but not very as fast as we would like, because I think with the announcement for Spaza Shops to go and register, the system in municipalities became overwhelmed. So the data we have received has been coming in very slow, and we are validating that data. When we reported yesterday in the portfolio committee, we did indicate that we have been able to validate about 7,500 spaza shops across four provinces, which is Gauteng, Western Cape, Northern Cape, and Northwest. Just to be clear, we are not saying that is the total number of spaza shops in those places. We are saying it's the data we have where we are able to link a spaza shop to a geolocation, and we can be able to safely say, we know the owner here, we know all the contact details, we know they have a license, and so forth and so forth. And that process is ongoing.
Matt Dalwa, when we look at the fund and the number of applications that have been received from the spaza shops there, that is significantly less than the amount of spaza shops that you've been able to correctly locate and track, as you rightly mentioned just now. I want to get your thoughts around perhaps how it is that the department is going to be looking to approach this. It's understandable that the department would have some safeguards to ensure that whatever applications you receive correspond with your own database so that legitimate service providers are supported. How is the department managing this process to ensure that that support is handled appropriately? And how many spaza shops do we anticipate we might be able to assist by the end of the year?
So in terms of our process, we do verify the business license with the municipality to make sure that what we are being presented with is accurate. So that's part of the due diligence. We also do a physical verification where we go to the spaza shop to verify the address and to verify the owners and the details furnished before we approve the application. Just to remind also yourself and the listeners that the fund is strictly for South African owned spaza shops, which means that we do not in any way open the funding to other nationals other than South African citizens. The 150 million that the DSBD has put on the table to support this fund is estimated to support close to 2,408 qualifying spaza shops. Currently, we have approved 1,386. And currently we have disbursed 57 million, which is just over 50% of the funding that we have available. We are on a drive to increase the number of spaza shops who are able to access this fund. And we are really hoping to have completed this fund by the end of the financial year. But it is subject to the spaza shop owners having the right documentation for us to be able to offer the fund to them. But we are working very closely with municipalities through our outreach campaign to assist spaza shop owners to apply, but also where they are not complying, to see what it is we can do to assist them to comply.
The Department of Small Business Development providing us with an update on the spaza shop fund that they have been administering on behalf of themselves, as well as the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition and other stakeholders. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Deputy Director General for Enterprise Development at the Department of Small Business, Qinisile Dalwa, for joining us to take a look at the work that they've been doing within the department and where that fund stands at the moment.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Arms Corps, the Arms Procurement Division of the Department of Defense in South Africa, has announced that it is looking to engage the expertise of external consultants to potentially review its portfolio of intellectual property assets. Now, when we last had some measure of this portfolio, it was estimated back in 2016, a little over 10 years ago, at being worth around 400 billion rand. We're going to see if we can make sense of these developments and this announcement in a bit more detail with our resident military and defense analyst, independent expert, Gwebus Murray. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Gwebus, lovely having you back on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start perhaps with a bit of background here, a bit of history around this particular intellectual property portfolio. How did it come to be? How did it get to the point where it was? And the data that we have around it, what do we know here?
Jimmy, one must remember that Arms Corps was, in the days prior to democracy, was the sole government entity to do research and development and manufacture defense equipment and technology. At that stage, obviously, we had all the arms embargoes against us, against the previous regime. They obviously was incredibly successful to develop world-class and world-leading intellectual properties for defense equipment and platforms. Since democracy, obviously there was an unbundling of Arms Corps. Many of that, or most of the manufacturing side, was moved into the Nell Group, the state-owned enterprise, state-owned company. And we know what happened over many years. There was a defunding, one can call it, of the military expenses. And one must remember that not only in South Africa was Arms Corps, in the case of Arms Corps and the Nell, the primary client is normally your local defense force. And therefore, all the intellectual properties that was developed for strategic reasons and for sovereignty reasons was kept in the hands and the ownership of government via these entities. Since, obviously, democracy, a lot of defunding has taken place. Priorities has changed. There was no traditional or typical defense or enemy that we had to prepare for. And in the process, because of the change in priorities, we have seen the deterioration of defense capabilities. In the process, Arms Corps has done less. The Nell has done less, and we know what the state of the defense force is. Fortunately, the defense industry and many of the people who are in the defense industry and has taken that forward are old employees of both Arms Corps and the Nell. So they have maintained the research and development, and they have basically moved well beyond the intellectual property value that we have got. Remember, the old intellectual property that we talk about in the hands of Arms Corps, some of that is in the hands of the Nell, some of it is in Arms Corps, but anyway, it belongs to government. However, many of those technologies and intellectual properties is now outdated properties. So the intellectual capacity and the capability of people has also been lost. So what the value currently is of the intellectual property in the hands of Arms Corps alone is most certainly not that number anymore. And it is, you know, one can debate really what the value is. There are certainly some values available, but we have lost that to a large extent, which is, reflected in the state of our defense force to a large extent.
Well, Mkobus, can we then look at how we commercialize it? If we are to say that perhaps involving private partnerships in evaluating the portfolio, reviewing the portfolio, commercializing the assets that we see here, yeah, how then do we go about it in a manner that one revives or potentially revives the defense sector in the country? I mean, we did have one of the best defense sectors on the continent when at its peak. How then do we approach this review such that it does yield positive results?
Remember, as I've said, the private sector, state-owned enterprise, or not state-owned enterprise, but the South African defense industry companies, they have maintained a global presence, and they have done research and development well beyond, what Arms Corps and the Nell has been left behind with. So they are still there. We've just had the Defence Lekgotla, and at the Defence Lekgotla, it was agreed that the government do not have the capability to fund the change that we need. Remember, we have got a GDP of just over 1%. And we need a remarkably much higher GDP to be able to fund the required 1 to 1.5% of GDP defense budget. Now, if you do not have a defense force that can spend that, that means that the state and state-owned companies supporting the defense cannot do that. So it has been agreed upon and everybody has accepted that this cannot be done alone. Government just don't have the money, and one must be honest about how the defense world has changed from you know, this very close business entity and environment that we were used to in the old days to a very open society where so many people are working together, either in terms of a strong strategic agreements or in terms of components or research and development. Just in terms of the South African defense industry members, there is enormous capabilities. I mean, you can just look at Paramount, you can look at Milcor, you can look at Rheinmetall, Danel, you can look at Hensoldt, you can look at Reutech, you can look at so many of the companies that has shown that they can be competitive in the global world. What has been dragging them back, and has been a problem for them, is that they don't get any support from our own defense force.
We certainly need to be doing more if we are to unlock the value that we aim to unlock here and look to revive the defense sector of the country. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Independent military and defense expert Kobus Mare joining us to share his thoughts around Arms Corps' decision to review their intellectual property portfolio.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, the part of the show where we get to spotlight small businesses and showcase those businesses to you, our SAFM audience. This week's small business, in keeping with our theme of Women's Month, is a business taking women to new heights, almost quite literally. The business is called Neo Heights Aviation Group, and I'm joined on the line by the company's founder and chief executive officer, Neo Makgale, to take a look at her business, get a sense of what it is that they do. Neo, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Neo Heights Aviation Group. How did this business come about?
Amazing. Thank you very much, Jimmy. And thank you for having me. It has been a long journey. It has not been easy. Basically, Neo Heights Aviation is an aviation solutions company where we have your Fly Near Voyager Club. We have your Fly Near, which is an airline. We have the Fly Near Academy and also the Neo Heights Foundation. So that's what we do, basically.
Now, how did you build this business? What was the vision here behind having not just the training side of it, but the airline aspect of it and the personalized charter services? How did this whole business come together?
Okay, it started about 15 years back. I was working for two airlines before this, and the second airline internationally, while traveling around the world, I realized the gap in the market, in the aviation sector. And I thought, why not go back home to South Africa and do this and also just impart and also draw a picture of what I've seen around the world? So coming back to South Africa from Doha, I then did my research as to how do I then get into the system. And that's how it came about.
Now, how do your services work? Because I imagine as a private operator in a highly competitive aviation sector, there isn't a lot that you are able to do, perhaps, that some of the other more commercial services are able to provide. But it also means that your services are more unique. Take us through how you're able to then position your business to be competitive in South Africa's aviation market.
Okay, Jimmy, what I would say is we don't only focus on the airline itself, but everything around it. I'd say the lifestyle around it. what we did is come up with ways to make it easier to make flying affordable, to just show that the aviation, or rather the flying experience, is not only for the elite or people who are rich, as we would say, but we came up with ways where everybody in every level of life will be able to afford it, to afford the lifestyle. We have packages where anybody really, like you, a couple who wants just to go for a weekend away, to a group of people who just want to travel overseas, can be accommodated. So that's what we have done, just to make it easier and to make it affordable.
Now, what's been the biggest challenge building a business in the aviation industry for you? You mentioned that you came back to South Africa with international experience under your belt, but I can imagine starting a business like this in the South African market, especially after the amount of other commercial airlines we've seen that have struggled in this market. What's been the biggest challenge for you, and how have you been able to get your business over that?
Right, you know, aviation is still a very male-dominated and capital-intensive industry. And again, as a woman-led, we face challenges around access to funding, perception of capability, and the need to constantly prove yourself in rooms where people may not expect to see a woman to be leading an airline project. So really, it has just been that. And also, people don't watch to see what you do. They don't just watch to see if you succeed, but also to see whether a Black woman can lead in the space. It is very, very heavy, but it fuels me as a woman, because I never wanted to give up, and I don't think I'll ever will.
Now, what does not giving up look like for your business today and going forward? You've built out the airline aspect of the business. You've built out all the other divisions within the group that we touched on earlier. How do you now grow your business, and what does that growth look like in terms of the vision you've always had for this business?
Ultimately, success for me looks like passengers and members saying, "I belong here." And also young women looking at this, what I do, and seeing that there is space for them to lead as well. So for me, not giving up means that I have a lot of people looking up to me. And the day I decide to give up, it means the whole lot of people will be let down. So I keep myself motivated. I keep myself around people who motivate me as well. And you know what, 15 years down the line, I'm still here and I'm still pushing.
Not giving up is fundamental and essential towards achieving success, especially when you're looking to build a business in markets that might not always be as open and as welcoming. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note, but of course it is available as a podcast for you to catch up on if you miss the conversation. Founder and Chief Executive Officer at Neo Heights Aviation Group, Neo Makgala, joining us for this week's SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know the sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider. FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And just like that, folks, that's the update for the show. That's also the update for the week. If you've missed any of our conversations, you know you can catch up on them as podcasts on our MoneyWeb platform. They'll be made available there. Of course, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hurst is standing by with the latest round of evening news. He will, of course, be followed by the award-winning top sport team led by Michael Abramson, which means from my side, good night.